Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is, to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofino. We had two cases set for oral submission this morning, but some more things were filed in the second one, and so we have postponed that. So you are the whole show today. You have our undivided attention as far as oral submissions are concerned. I understand both sides are ready. So if you call the case, we'll get started. Okay, you ready?
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Joe Spence along with Keith Ogle representing the appellant Kodiak. There are three motions for summary judgment that orders were granted on that we challenge on appeal. The first one was a traditional motion for summary judgment that was against our misappropriation of trade secret, Texas Theft Liability Act, and common law, well, conversion, and then also common law unfair competition by misappropriation. That was granted solely on an affirmative defense asserted by Mr. DeGeer and DMAX for release in light of a 2009 settlement agreement. The second motion for summary judgment followed that was a no evidence motion that went against what is now become known as paragraph 42 and 43 of our first amended petition. There was some dispute below as to what our allegations were and what their no evidence motion was actually directed to. But that was granted. On those two, we asked for a reversal and a remand. The third motion was a traditional motion on filed by the defendants, the appellees, on their counterclaim for declaratory judgment. And that was granted. It was a no evidence motion. We believe that was an improper grant. They got an attendant award of fees under 37009. We ask that that summary judgment order be reversed and that this court render judgment that the appellees take nothing on their counterclaim for declaratory relief. Let me start, if I may, with the first motion, the traditional motion that threw out several of our claims based on the affirmative defense asserted by DeGeer and DMAX of release. I think it has to be characterized in the backdrop of what actually occurred here. This was essentially what I call a business divorce. Our client, Bill Glidewell, who founded Kodiak, and Mr. DeGeer had been long-standing colleagues in Kodiak. And they just got crosswise. And so it was part of the lawsuits were filed back and forth in 2009. And part of the way the divorce was settled, if you will, is the parties entered into a 2009 settlement agreement. And the very first paragraph of the settlement agreement defines a term of art known as the effective date and defines that as October 5th, 2009. In the agreement, there were mutual releases. Kodiak, in the release section, only released DeGeer from claims that arose prior to or at the time of the effective date of the settlement agreement. And again, effective date was a term of art. So when DeGeer walked away from the settlement table, under Texas law, he continued to have a duty not to use or disclose any of the trade secrets that he had acquired, albeit properly, because he worked for Kodiak and had him in his head, if you will. This isn't a case of somebody going in and picking the lock of the safe and stealing a trade secret, i.e. gaining it improperly. He had knowledge of this. But when he walked away from the settlement table under Texas law, he had a continuing duty to not use or disclose any trade secrets in the future. And this is true under the law, whether there exists a non-compete agreement or whether there exists a non-disclosure agreement. And rest assured, Kodiak's position below and here and has always been, DeGeer had the right to compete with us the day he walked away from the settlement table. He could go across the street, set up his own brake company, and start competing with us. We've never taken the position he couldn't do that. Under the law, he had the right to use any public information he could find. He had the right under the cases to use his general knowledge, skill, and experience to compete. But what he didn't have the right to do is to compete unfairly with us by disclosing or using trade secrets that he had acquired knowledge of while an employee of Kodiak. And so I guess to sum all that up, there's nothing, our position is there's nothing in the 2009 settlement agreement or the language that would evidence that my client had any intent to release Mr. DeGeer for claims for wrongful conduct that would occur a year or two down the road when Mr. DeGeer started his new company, D-Max, and began using, as we've alleged, our trade secrets to unfairly compete against us. The continuing duty that I discussed is found in a case that was decided by this court, Fox, which we cite in our brief, along with Norwood, which followed it, which was an 08 case from this court. The rule can be stated as, even in the absence of an enforceable non-disclosure agreement, a former employee may not use confidential information or trade secrets the employee learned in the course of his employment for his own advantage and to the detriment of his employer. We cited a case called Reliant Hospital that says that duty survives the termination of employment. We cited a case from this court called NewMed, which says the rule applies even if use or disclosure is not prohibited or restrained by an express written contract. So, it is in this backdrop that our opponent has interpreted the release to say, well, even though these claims arose 2 years, two years down the road after the 2009 settlement agreement, he says, well, that settlement agreement covered all future claims. And so to analyze that, I think there's two principal rules that the court can utilize. One is called, I call it the mention rule, which comes from a case called Brady and another one called Keck. And the other one is the limiting language rule, which also comes from Brady. And those two rules say this, for a release a given claim, it has to mention that claim. That's what Brady said. Keck came along and said, well, okay, you don't have to list each and every claim and identify each and every claim, but it still has to be mentioned. And that's why we cited the Stafford case, which I think is a really good case from our standpoint, because in that case, the agreement had language that said, quote, future, close quote, claims are being released. Also, the court noted, with regard to the settlement in that agreement in that case, it says, nor is the settlement agreement limited to claims that existed at the time the release was executed. So in Stafford, they said, not only does it say future, but there's no limiting language in the release in Stafford. In turn, when you go under the limiting language rule and look to our case, we clearly have that language in our release in paragraph 2.4. I might add the limiting language can be of a subjective nature. In Brady, it said any claims attributable to a specific note or loan transaction. So the subject was limited. It can be a date-based. So for instance, we cited the Keck case, and in there it said any claims being released regarding the rendition of legal services from a date in 1988 to a date in 1992. So it was date limited. The case we principally rely on to help support our position about this language of limitation is the A2D case. And in that case, it had language in there somewhat similar to ours that said all claims arising prior to the date first above mentioned. And the interesting facts in that case are, in 1983, I believe, there was a company called Riley that does well logs, and they had a technique where they reduced them to half size and put their own trademark on the well logs. Another company started using and selling their well logs with their trademark, with Riley's trademark on it. So Riley sued them for trademark infringement. Case was settled. 20 years later, Riley, it was the successor of Riley, sued the original defendant for trademark infringement. They came back and said, oh, that's been released. And in A2D, the court said, no, it wasn't. In light of that language, it had limiting language. The other thing in A2D, which I thought was an interesting quote, it said, these were sophisticated parties represented by counsel. It is not reasonable that they would agree to release all future claims only by strained interpretation, which again, I think in light of the duty that we know exists under Texas law that kept going after settlement, it takes a strained interpretation to interpret this release language to mean all future claims are being released.
But in the A2D case, the misconduct, the putting of the mark on a product occurred after the settlement, after the release. So I'm drawing a distinction in the conduct because here there's no indication that Mr. Deger obtained additional trade secrets or was on the premises of Kodiak or that there was any kind of misconduct, like physical misconduct,
yes,
after the release, correct?
That's true about R2D, and it's true about Mr. Deger here, but under the law, I think that that distinction doesn't matter in light of use of trade secrets and the law surrounding it. And that is because in this case, in this court in Mabry, said that liability for use of a trade secret can arise when one obtains the trade secret by improper means or when one discloses or uses after properly acquiring. And then the use under the Altai case talked about it accrues when it's used. And so you are correct. I think in the A2D case, there were improper use of the well logs with the trademark prior to the first agreement. And then subsequently, 20 years later, they started doing it again. Here, I think the distinction is that it's not just the fact that Mr. Deger somehow acquired, albeit properly, the trade secrets before the settlement was signed, i.e. while he was an employee. But under the law, after you move forward, if he decides to use it again, that is a separate violation because the use of a trade secret constitutes misappropriation just as much as the taking of it, if you will. There are some cases, traditional example, misappropriation, you know, I guess my lock, picking the lock at night at the safe of the company and getting the formula to Coke, or downloading files while you're an employee and putting them in your backpack and sneaking out. That's traditional misappropriation from the you stole it type. But the cases are clear that if you acquire it by improper means but use it later, that use in and of itself also is misappropriation. And I think that's why in both of these cases that distinction exists. I provided the court with a handout which was in our reply brief, which was filed yesterday. And it's really just a diagram of how we interpret the release language. And the reason I have done this is in light of the Appley's argument. They raised an argument in their Appley's brief using the doctrine of last antecedent. And their argument is essentially that the limiting language, which we claim is that language at the very bottom, which may have arisen or which may arise prior to or at the time of the effective date of this agreement, we believe that limiting language modifies all claims. Our opponents have said, well, under this doctrine of last antecedent, that limiting language at the very end really should only modify that last little bullet point right above it. And we just simply disagree. But in connection with our disagreement, I would point out two cases cited by Appley's in footnote 115 of their brief are two Texas Supreme Court cases which talk about, one, the rule of last antecedent generally only applies when ambiguity exists. They have no allegations of ambiguity in this case. If there were ambiguity, of course, then the summary judgment would have to be reversed. The cases also say that this doctrine is not controlling, it's flexible, and importantly, it can't be used to impair the meaning of the phrases, and it can't support sort of a nonsensical interpretation. And that's kind of our argument about this argument they're making of last antecedent is, if that last paragraph only modifies the bullet point above it, it would be almost as if they said, we're releasing all claims, oh, by the way, including past claims, which would always be released. It almost renders the whole thing meaningless. And our interpretation is those things in brackets are basically illustrative of the things that are we've highlighted in yellow. And at the end of the day, when you get down to the very bottom, that limiting language talked about, and again, it was the whole intent of this business divorce, everything up to this date, we're releasing. But in the backdrop of an ongoing duty, and by the way, I might add, they have argued things like, well, we should have got a non-compete, which again wouldn't have made any difference, or a non-disclosure. The reality is, under Texas law, with the existence of that duty, that ongoing duty, if Mr. DeGeer didn't want to be subject to that, the law, I think it was his obligation to put something in the agreement that said, oh, by the way, with regard to that ongoing duty that I have not to use your trade secrets, I want to be out of that. Let's carve that out. But he didn't. Anyway, the other thing I have to address very quickly before I sit down is there are two arguments they made in their appellee's brief on this point. One regards settlement. This argument, we pled settlement too, and it's a merger argument, and they also brought up res judicata. Those grounds, those issues were not grounds in the summary judgment motion, and therefore they're not preserved for review. Admittedly, there are cases that say if you raise certain grounds and the order grants on only one ground, like ground C, but A and B were in the motion, the appellate court can go ahead and look at A and B. But when they're not in the motion, oh, I'm sorry. Apologize, Your Honor. Didn't see that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Frank?
May it please the court. Counsel ignores the substance of our principal argument. He says that there is no continuing duty, or he says that there is a continuing duty. There was no continuing duty, and the parties put it into the compromise settlement agreement. There was an employment agreement that Mr. DeGeer had signed. The employment agreement had a merger clause which expressly merged all of his obligations to Kodiak into that employment agreement. And then in the settlement agreement, the employment agreement was terminated. Well, if the employment agreement was terminated, which had all of his obligations to Kodiak, then all of his obligations to Kodiak were terminated. And they don't ignore that, and we've got a case, they don't mention that. Indeed, we've got a case out of the Southern District of Texas, the Be Ready Productions against Cantrell, which is directly on point. We spend two pages of our brief talking about it, and they simply ignore it. They don't have a substantive response. They do have a procedural response. They say, oh, you didn't seek summary judgment on the grounds of merger. Well, the grounds aren't merger. The grounds are merger and termination, which was part of the settlement. And we did seek summary judgment on the grounds of settlement. We quote our summary judgment grounds in footnote 76. We say that we're seeking summary judgment on our affirmative defenses of settlement, release, and waiver. And there's plenty of cases that say that settlement is a separate ground. They say, well, you didn't argue it. Well, look at footnote 77. There we cite City of Roanoke against Town of Westlake and numerous other cases which say that you don't have to put argument in your summary judgment motion. You simply have to say the grounds. We put the grounds in there. The grounds are good. They can't respond to it. And that pretty much ends the trade secrets case. It also ends it against DMAX. DMAX wasn't in existence, but DMAX's claim is derivative of DeGeer. Their allegations are very clear. They say that DeGeer got the trade secrets while he was working for Kodiak, and then he gave them to DMAX. Well, if DeGeer has no obligation to preserve trade secrets because of the settlement agreement, obviously, DMAX has no obligation. It's like it's a derivative claim. It's like aiding and abetting. If you and I are sued, you're sued as the principal, and I'm sued for aiding and abetting, and you're not liable, I can't be held liable for aiding and abetting because there's no tort. Here, There's no tort because the claim against DeGear was settled. Therefore, DMAX can't be held liable. I want to talk briefly about the release. They cite the Stafford case. Well, the Stafford case does say that if you release future claims, you release future claims. Well, surprise. But it doesn't say that if you don't say future claims, you don't release future claims, which is what they want you to say that it says. They ignore our principal case here, the D. Horton case. In that case, the released all claims known and unknown, asserted and unasserted. And this court said that releases future claims. Well, there's a real reason for that. When you say all claims, you mean all claims. Now, lawyers are never courageous enough to put that into their settlement agreements and take that position. They always add things like known or unknown, or asserted or unasserted, or in this case, accrued or unaccrued. But under D.R. Horton, when you say all claims known or unknown, asserted or unasserted, you include future claims. In this case, we say all claims known or unknown, accrued or unaccrued. Accrued or unaccrued is actually stronger than asserted or unasserted, because unaccrued means unmatured. That implies future claims. They don't have an answer to that. They don't talk about D. Horton. They don't try to distinguish it. They mention A to D, but there is an important difference in there. In A to D, they released all claims asserted by Riley. That didn't cover future claims. We don't have a claim that type language here, so that's a way to distinguish A to D. Now, we have a broad release which releases all claims, including future claims, and we have the final clause which says, which may have arisen or may arise prior to or at the time of the effective date of the agreement. And they talk about the doctrine of last antecedent, and we've briefed it. The doctrine of last antecedent exists to avoid ambiguity. If you've got a floating modifier out here, what on earth does it modify? Well, that can make the provision ambiguous. But under the doctrine of last antecedent, we know what it modifies, absent other indications. Now, we've got another argument there. We also say that the claims, when he says all claims arising, it means all claims arising from the events and allegations in the 2009 lawsuit. Where do we get that language? We get it from the preamble to the settlement agreement. That language is in there, and that's what arise means. This claim does arise from the events and allegations set forth in the 2009 lawsuit. They say that DeGear, in the earlier lawsuit, they say DeGear got the trade secrets. Now they say he's using those same trade secrets. Now, having said that, I want to spend the rest of my time on our counterclaim. The law is simple. Well, it's simply stated. The law is that if we get a declaratory judgment of non-liability, we can't recover attorney's fees. But if our declaratory judgment has greater ramifications, or if we get additional relief, we can. Now, in this case, we got to think about what their claim is. As we all know, they say that Mr. DeGear took the alleged trade secrets while he was at Kodiak. He gave them to DMAX, and he and DMAX are using them, and they are suing him and DMAX only. We say they're not suing DMAX for trade secrets, but that's a procedural question. For purpose of this argument, I'll include DMAX. The release was much broader. It did not just cover those claims. It covered other claims, and we've laid those out fairly succinctly, I think, on page 11 of our brief. And the release contained provisions saying it also cover claims regardless of whether the claims are connected in any way with DeGear's relationship with DMAX. Well, that covers the situation that counsel and Justice Walker had the colloquy about, where we could go and get after DeGear leaves, he could go to Kodiak and find some employee and get some more trade secrets. That's not what they're alleging, but the release covers that. Similarly, it covers claims against anyone acting through or on DeGear's behalf, and it lists a number of people, employees, directors, and other people. Well, that covers the situation where they lose this suit and they turn around and sue one of our employees, or we sell DMAX and they sue the new buyer. That claim is also released. The release is broader than the claims that they are making here. Well, we got a declaratory judgment that those claims have been released as well. That's what the declaratory judgment says. Judge Lowe didn't have to give it to us, but he chose to. And why did he give it to us? Well, consider the history of this case. They file the suit against us. They go in and get a TRO. They file this suit against us. They go in and get a TRO and an ex parte order for expedited discovery, and they run up $200,000 in attorney's fees on our part, and they never tell the trial judge that there was a release. The trial judge finally learned it and was displeased. They would have had a harder time if we had had a declaratory judgment saying that that claim had been released. They would really have a hard time saying, well, we don't know if the claim's been released, because we'd have a declaratory judgment that says our claim's been released. Well, Judge Lowe apparently thought, and the record would indicate, that they're not done. They still may sue some of our employees. They may assert a claim that, in fact, we got trade secrets from them after Chuck DeGear left employment. We may sell the company, and they may sue the new buyer. All of those claims are covered by the release, and now we have a declaratory judgment that says that. And that is going to make it harder on them the next time. Now, that really doesn't make any difference as to the question before you today. The question before you today is this. Did, in our declaratory judgment, did we get something more than a declaratory judgment of non-liability for this claim? And we did. Yes, we got a declaratory judgment that the release covers the claims that they have asserted, but we also got a declaratory judgment that the release covers these other claims. Their only response to this argument, as far as I can tell, is, well, it was in the release. Duh, of course it was in the release. That's why we got it to begin with. But again, Judge Lowe didn't have to give it to us. Now, but he did. And because he did, we're entitled to attorney's fees under the MBM case. I think if the court doesn't have any further questions. I believe I think that's all I have, and I'll give the rest of the time back.
Counsel, I haven't seen the declaratory judgment that was signed by Judge Lowe. Is that attached to something?
No, it's in the record, though.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, my question is, how can he issue a declaratory judgment concerning parties that aren't before the court?
He doesn't declare did issue a declaratory judgment that is, say, res judicata as to those parties. But he does enter a declaratory judgment as to what the release means. Moreover, he did it, and they're not complaining about it. They have not raised that argument. Why Judge Lowe did it is not before the court. But to answer your question, we can get that release, and if he sues someone else, if they sue someone else, then that will be powerful language. That will be powerful language that we can use in the trial court. But no, it will not directly affect the rights of other parties because they're not present. All right, thank you very much.
Jeff?
I'll start from that last issue and work back, if I may. The counterclaim for declaratory judgment, we believe the rule is set forth in the BHP Petroleum case, and then we cited a bunch of cases, Sanchez, Heckey, Exploration, Warren Tech from this court, stands for the proposition that a counterclaim for declaratory judgment that seeks no affirmative relief and simply reiterates or argues the same issues that were related to that defendant's prior asserted and, in this case, ruled on summary judgment affirmative defense, that it's improper. And the test is to look at declaratory judgment relief that was granted, what is that relief, and compare it, I think, to what they asked for in their motion for summary judgment on their affirmative defense of settlement and release. And so in our brief, opening brief at 69 through 74, I compared, and it's at CR 1480, the original order, I compared the five declarations in the declaratory judgment summary judgment order with the exact issues that Daguerre and DMAX raised in their prior motion for summary judgment on the affirmative defense of settlement and release. And they're identical, including all of these things he just mentioned. I address this in the reply brief as well at 24 through 27. So our point is these issues were clearly raised, clearly addressed in the proceedings regarding their affirmative defense of settlement release. Back to this issue of the non-competition and non-disclosure and him saying those were merged. At some level, all of that's academic because none of that, and they haven't cited any cases that say that even if we got rid of any prior non-competition and non-disclosure agreements between Kodiak and Daguerre, that this duty under the law was also terminated. It's a common law duty that exists. And so the reality is, our position is that duty continued, and the parties are presumed to know the law at the time of contracting. This argument that their settlement ground in the motion for summary judgment, they never mentioned any of this merger or settlement in their motion for summary judgment. That's at CR 554-556.
I have a question.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Don't we still, your position is that the common law duty to continue to not use trade secrets, but the language of the release that we're looking at says, including but not limited to any claims or causes of action arising under contract, any law, common or statutory. So isn't that common law duty included within the release, and basically doesn't the whole issue rise or fall on whether or not future claims are being released or not under this provision?
The reference to common law there would still be subject to the limiting language, and he would still have owed a common law duty while an employee outside of any contractual obligations. He agreed, because some employees don't sign non-competes or non-disclosure contracts, but they still, as an employee, you have a common law duty not to disclose or use confidential information and trade secrets. So I would say that, yes, that refers to common law claims that Kodiak had prior to the settlement agreement to the extent Daguerre's actions leading up and prior to the settlement agreement violated any contractual obligations he owed us or common law obligations he had with regard to his use and disclosure of trade secrets. Ultimately, I think it still gets back to this duty exists, and would this release cover the breach of that same duty in the future? I do agree with you on that. Anyway, back to the issue of their motion for summary judgment. When they raised this issue of settlement, which again, all they focused on was the release language. They never focused on anything else in their motion about this, that settlement is a different defense or that somehow this merger issue involving settlement was a ground for their summary judgment. So that's why we believe that they didn't preserve it. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. And you're free to go about your business. This court will be adjourned.
A little bit.